welcome to this special episode of the Outrider Podcast. I, of course, am Jason Quinn Malott. We're doing something this month I'm calling Shop Talk with Laura Hawley. Some of you might remember Laura from a previous episode of the Outrider Podcast. Laura's a friend of mine from graduate school, who I think is a very, very gifted and talented writer, but who has been kind of off the radar and not producing a lot lately for a lot of reasons. Some of them one of the more recent and dramatic ones we talk about briefly at the beginning of our conversation. But the basic point, what I'm trying to get across here with this special episode, Shop Talk, which I hope might become a regular series, is one of the things I miss the most about graduate school is the regular conversations that Laura and I used to have when we were working on stories. We seem to have a very good rapport and a very strong connection creatively. Although we were both doing different things and interested in doing different things, there were aspects of her writing that I was desperate to steal. I don't know how else to put it. It was always really good to talk to her because we kind of understood what each other was trying to do creatively, and were able to challenge and push the other person and think of solutions that the other was stuck on. It was a great dynamic that we had, and I've been missing that a lot. And I'm currently stuck on the ending of a story and wanted to talk to her about it. And so a couple of little light bulbs all went off in my head all at once at that point. And I thought, well, wait a minute. Laura and I have talked repeatedly about how we both feel like we're in kind of creative barren places where we're not around a lot of people who are pursuing writing. Now, I've been trying to do some stuff around here in Wichita where I live to improve that. But it takes time, you know, to find your comfort level to talk about certain things with other writers. You know, you got to figure out what it is they write, you know, at least for me anyway. It's kind of like taking on a new lover at times, I suppose. That might be overdramatic. I don't know. But it's, you know, someone who really gets what you're trying to do tends to, they don't always give you what you need, but they give you the best direction. They might give you that thing that just kind of nudges you a little out of your center long enough to see a solution. And the people that I'm friends with here in Wichita, they're all very good. I like hanging out with them. They're good writers. They're talented. Some of them are not published. Most of them are not published. But that doesn't matter. I love talking to them. They were just over at my apartment for the last Saturday Writers Salon that I'm hosting. And we had a great time. I might have overshared, but that's okay. I put a little wine in me. I apparently just... I guess it's what happens when you end up living alone and not getting out in the world very often. Anyway, whoop, I'm way off the bonkers here. But the other day was that maybe if I could get Laura talking about writing again on a regular basis, it would get that little nugget of a fire going underneath her and she might start writing again. Because as I've told her, I think in this conversation and other times, is that to me, I think that there is a loss in the world because she's not writing. That's my opinion anyway. But just in case, you know, since you're here now listening, and I would recommend you go back and listen to that conversation and that story of Laura's that I read, but just for shits and giggles, I'm going to read the opening paragraph of her short story, The Good Life, which was the final story, the capper, in the Best New American Voices anthology from 2003 that was edited by Joyce Carol Oates. And this is the opening paragraph to Laura Hawley's The Good Life. From our bedroom window, we can see our neighbor's driveway. He lives to our right, up on the hill. His house is 7,500 square feet, and there are usually six cars parked at the top of the drive. Terry thinks he lives alone, that he's around our age, maybe 35, one of those upstart computer engineers from California. His driveway has horizontal grooves dug into the concrete from top to bottom. Our realtor tried to sell us on this feature, the heated driveway, but we passed. Our drive isn't that long, and it isn't too steep. Before we go to bed, we make bets on which car our neighbor is going to take to work the next day. Terry always wins. She's figured out his routine. The BMW on Monday, the Explorer on Tuesday, the Land Rover on Wednesday, and so on. Terry's more observant than I am. Or maybe I just like letting her win. And the story's fabulous. There's this kind of creepy, haunting going on in this brand new built home. And this was something that Laura and I had talked about in graduate school a lot, this idea of the new American suburb as a version of as kind of the American Gothic. We don't have these deep, long historical landmarks in a lot of parts of this country, particularly like in Colorado and things like this. I mean, nothing's more than maybe 100, 150, 200 years old. That's not very long at all. You know, you go to places like pretty on the east coast of America, and then you jump over to Europe, and you've got stuff that's been there for, you know, closing in on 1,000 years, 800 years, 900 years. That's a lot of history. And so you've really got a good, that's classic Gothicism. And when we were in graduate school, we had thought about, you know, what is an American Gothic when everything is new? Is it that absence of individuality, the vacantness of suburbia that can have a certain Gothic tone to it? And her story, The Good Life, has some, from my interpretation, has some deep, deep Gothic undertones. It's a great story. Pick it up and read it. So here we are. I called up Laura, wanted to talk to her about a story that I'm stuck on, and we went on and talked and had a good time. And I hope those writers out there struggling in creatively barren places where there aren't a lot of other writers might get some use out of this, just hearing people, what a pair of sympathetic writers actually end up doing when they just jabber at each other about stuff. I never really heard any of that when I was coming up as a writer, and don't hear it very much in the other podcasts I listen to. So I figured I'd give it a shot and see how it goes. So here we go. Here's my conversation with Laura Holly.
Hello?
Hey, Laura.
Hey. Hello.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I got in a bike ride today and then had a little dinner, and I've got a glass of wine, so I'm doing good. How
do you good. Have
Yeah. Are you beveraged up? Do you have something to drink?
Oh yeah, I'm fine.
All righty.
Yeah.
There were many, many reasons I wanted to talk to you again. And because, you know, the last time I had you on the podcast, you dropped that little bombshell that you had cancer.
Yeah. No bombshells today.
Nope. Right. But I thought I would have you give everybody the good news. You've been through treatment.
Yep.
And?
And there's no more cancer.
Yay!
That we know of. But, you know, as of now, I'm running with that. And that's the way I'm interpreting everything. And going with,
right.
So just follow-up appointments just to kind of check on thyroid hormone levels and
right,
all that
right.
kind of stuff, and should be good.
Cool. So if you are, but you are officially cancer-free.
I am, yes.
That's good news.
Yes, happened very quickly and less very quickly.
Well, good. So have you at least been thinking about writing?
Yes.
Okay.
I have.
Because when you replied to my email, it was just like very short and curt. I don't write anymore, but I was like, what?
Yeah. No, I've been thinking about it.
Okay.
I tried, I don't know, 2 weeks ago, I opened up a notebook and wrote two words. I think it was an article and a preposition, and I crossed them out and shut the notebook.
Well, maybe if we can get into this as a ritual. Whoops, still there? Lost the call.
Hello?
Oh, you dropped out there for a moment.
Yeah, we lost connection there.
Oh, well. Where was I? Oh, well, maybe if we can get into a habit of a monthly talk here, it'll spark you a little bit. That's what I'm hoping.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Just because, and because it also feeds my little greedy, selfish need is to have a regular conversation with someone who gets me as a writer.
Yeah. Hey, that's fair.
You know, because, you know, there are writers here in town that I'm friends with that I talk to and do things with, but I haven't run across anyone that really kind of has locked in to kind of what I was doing and who I locked into as well.
Yeah.
You know,
Well, we met each other at the beginning of everything, you know,
yeah.
When you were really coming into your own as far as being a writer and.
Well, that was a big moment in grad school that I think that both of us had.
Yep.
Kind of centered around Chris Baer of all people.
Oh yeah. That was huge. Yeah. That changed everything.
Yeah, I remember both of us kind of being really disappointed with that first story that we handed him for the one-on-one thing.
Oh, God.
Right?
Yeah. Yep.
Didn't he ask you are you sure you're ready for this?
Yeah, he did. And
like
I
that?
Was like, yeah. he said something about, like, how old are you again? I said, I'll be 22. God, I was so young. And he goes, are you sure you're ready for this? I was like, I have been my whole life.
Right.
But I needed that wake-up call of, you know, this is shit.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, that was kind of what I was thinking about all day. I was like, kind of how, what would be the first thing we could talk about, you know, aside from what are you reading now? And it was, it was this notion how, maybe this will be useful to whatever handful of listeners I have out there, but this notion of, well, I think it's kind of a combination of Jack Spicer's idea of oppositional magic, but also mixed in with Naropa's kind of aversion to competition.
Mm.
You know, we weren't really a competitive bunch, but then again, you know, we I don't know about you in particular, but I know that I spent a lot of time in grad school writing against other people.
No, I know I did. I think that's what kept me going, why I wrote so much.
You know, it's like there's this person doing this thing and I want to one up them. And it wasn't a sense.
Yeah.
And what I meant by it, you know, that Naropa aversion to competition, that was that it wasn't, at least among you and me and Gavin and Evan and Jen and all the other people that we kind of hung out with and wrote against, it wasn't that I'm going to show you.
No.
Take that type of thing. It was like, can I outdo that person? And we wanted that other person to outdo us because that meant we had to go back and outdo them on the next one.
Exactly. It was like a competition against yourself.
Yeah. And it was the other people's responsibility to raise the bar.
Yeah.
On you. It was like, it was almost like a limbo competition. Well, to go the other direction, it was almost like a limbo competition where you didn't know how high or how low that bar was going to be, but you had to figure out how to get under it. And
yeah,
you know, yeah,
exactly.
We failed or did whatever. And I don't know. I haven't felt that same kind of, competition since graduate school. I mean, I've been looking for it desperately. You know, I try to find some kind of writer to lean against, and it hasn't really worked that well.
Yeah, and I can say honestly, I haven't had that experience either in school. But, I think part of it is where our lives took us as far as like jobs and things like that. We ended up in places where writing, if anybody did it, was a hobby, or they thought they were, and it wasn't anything serious. So it's hard to find that.
It's true. Wow. Guess I
Kind of
could have.
sad.
Yeah. And well, if I hadn't been enough, if I hadn't been quote unquote insubordinate, I could have stayed in Colorado.
Oh, goodness.
Oh well, what the fuck? You're young, you make mistakes.
Yeah. I realize it's been 15 years. That blows my mind.
I know. It doesn't feel like it's been that long.
It doesn't.
Yeah, so I'm 42.
Yeah. I'll be 42 one day.
Someday you'll be
Yeah,
there.
someday I'll be there. Pretty close. Closer than I
Keep
was
trying to
15 years
catch me.
ago,
It's
that's for
not gonna
sure.
work.
Yeah.
So what are you reading right now that you're finished with nursing school and have the job and the schedule and everything and you're cancer free? What have you picked up lately?
I picked up David Sedaris. You're gonna love him. I
Okay.
think he's hilarious. I got what was it called? Let's Discuss Diabetes with Owls.
Oh, right.
Oh, it's awesome. Just most of it was essays about his living abroad, like in London and not in London, but yeah, partially London, some little countrysides in England and a little bit of France. But he is so funny, and it's like he just takes these, he makes his life so dramatic, which he's gonna do. But it really, I almost started writing after reading him. I got so close. Like I was saying before we got cut off, I actually opened up a notebook and wrote two words, crossed them out and shut the notebook. And they weren't even real words. It was so frustrating. I'm like, I was so excited. Oh, I could write a little essay. I could do this. And
Yeah, he's he when he comes through Kansas, whether he reads in Salina at the Stiefel Theater or down here in Wichita or something like that, he requests that Watermark do the book sales.
Oh, very
That
cool.
might be a secret I should not have let out, but I don't know. I don't work for
Oh,
Watermark anymore, and I broke up
yeah,
with
no.
Rebecca 6 months ago, and I just happen to know shit.
Yeah, exactly. That's really cool.
But yes, so
That makes me respect him even more.
I think I did one. I was working at Watermark for one time when he came through Wichita, I think. I didn't work the event, but yeah, every time he would come through and do stuff with Watermark, Rebecca would come home with stories about, the signings. Because he apparently likes to tell off-color jokes to people as they're getting their book signed.
Yeah.
And usually to inappropriately aged children, you know.
Of course.
And,
Yeah, he
but
seems like the
yeah.
kind that would do that.
So yeah, I mean he is a great guy, and he does take care of independent bookstores, that
Very good.
because that's the important thing, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, I bought his book at Barnes and Noble, but
Well,
what I like you.
Oh well. Money's money. Books are
Yep,
books.
exactly.
Just don't do it at Amazon.
No, I don't like Amazon at all.
Do you have
It's
anything? A what?
Oh, go ahead.
No, do you have anything else on your list? What's
I picked up the collected stories of Lydia Davis.
Oh.
And it's a big fat book. It should keep me busy for a while, and it's really cool. It has really cool paper, so I'm very excited about it.
I don't think I've read anything by her. Have you read anything by her before?
I haven't, but I remember hearing about her in grad school, and I did this literature map, I don't know if you've seen it, where you can put in an author and then it maps out like kind of like a mind
Oh,
map, if you will, of like authors that are similar to them.
right.
So I was kind of stuck, like, who do I want to read? So I, of course, put it on Dottie, and I kind of checked out some of the names. I'm like, well, I haven't heard of these people. I don't know if I want to take a risk on them yet. And so then I put in Laird Hunt because I love Laird, and
Right.
put in his name, and Lydia Davis popped up. I went, oh yeah. And then I realized that she did short stories, and I'm like, that's perfect. If I want to, get inspired to write anything, I really should start reading some more shorts, because
Right.
there's no way I'm doing a novel. There's no way. So,
Well, you gotta start somewhere, and it's been a few years.
yeah. Yeah, so I figured just, getting back into it, remembering that short stories do exist and that they can stand on their own, they can be good, and that people who write them can be successful is always a good
Yeah.
reminder.
Maybe I need to get back to a short story. I don't know.
Oh,
I mean,
you're more
that's
of a
the thing.
marathon runner.
Well, I've been reading Runner's World as I try to get back in shape and back in shape. Back last time I was in shape, I was maybe 16. So as I try to get in shape, not back in shape, to get in
Right.
shape, I've been reading a Runner's World, and even marathoners work on sprints.
Yeah.
So,
That's small.
I should at least
Yeah.
make attempts at short stories, or at least get back to writing poetry, which is something I've not been
Yeah.
doing a lot of lately. That might be kind of why my gears are all gummed up and why I'm having the problems that maybe I'll talk to you about in a little bit. But so
It was
Lydia
interesting, the
Davis,
poetry thing.
yeah.
Did you know that when I went to Naropa, I almost went in for poetry?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what made me decide to send them stories instead, but I was going to possibly do poetry, and it's really funny. Things would have changed. They're very different.
Well, you could have gone in as prose and then just taken a lot of poetry stuff and pulled a Jen Zukowski and been the
That's
poetry
true.
ninja.
That's true. But anyway, off subject. Go back to what you're saying.
So, Lydia Davis and David Sedaris.
Yep.
Who else have you got in your stack?
Annie Poole, trying to get through the shipping news, and it's kind of painful.
Really?
Yeah, I loved Postcards, which is I think her first book. Loved it, and so I picked up the shipping news because I love the movie. One of those people who watch the movie first, and been trying to get through it, and I just. It's interesting. It's just kind of painful at times. I don't know why.
I wonder if I would have the same feeling if I went back and read it again now. Because
Yeah, it's different.
when I first read it, I loved it. I mean, not at the level that I love a lot of other stuff, but
Yeah.
it's something that I've kept in my collection. It's tucked, well, I don't have it on any of my shelves right now because I still need one more bookcase to get all of my books out of my mother's basement.
Yeah, another feeling.
So, yeah. But I've kept it around and I've flipped through it a lot, but maybe I should try and reread it again.
Yeah, I mean, she's obviously a very good writer. I'm
Yeah.
enjoying that, but it just for some reason something's not clicking. I might
Right,
be
right.
reading it a long time.
Could be, yeah.
That happens.
Yeah, it does. It does. Yeah, when I talked to Laird, I talked to him about how I think I might have not been in the right place to get the impossibly or the exquisite. I kind of got hung up on those. I mean, his other ones,
Yeah.
I've blown through, just adored them. And I liked what I was doing. I liked what I was reading with the impossibly and the exquisite. I liked it, but and it was kind of like it's kind of like the first analogy that pops into my head is it's like playing with a vibrator but not getting it in the right place.
That's a good analogy. Oh,
That feels kind of good, but I don't think it goes there.
how
So,
funny.
yeah, you think
Yeah,
you'd tell where my brain's
I
going
get
with
it. How
that? All right. So,
funny.
yeah. Anything else, or have you
That's
just
about it. What are you reading?
well, I'm. Let's
Says Runner's
see.
World.
I'm picking up finally, and I've started reading it before and gave it up for other things for a lot of different reasons. Reading Hick by Andrea Portis.
Okay.
And I should have read that a long time ago. But I'm reading it now. She's got another novel out called Bury This, I think. She's got a third one coming out, and either that one or she's got a fourth one that's a YA book that's already been optioned for a movie.
Oh, they're
So she's
loving those
working
young
on
adult books.
So she's on her third or fourth book that's coming out this year. Or maybe her
Okay.
third and fourth are coming out this year. I don't know. But she just, it was like between Hick and her second novel was this big long stretch. And then she's just bang, one, two, three in a row. Oh, and they did make her first book, Hick, into a movie. It had Alec Baldwin in it and
Oh, really?
Chloe Grace Moretz or whatever her name is.
Oh, nice.
So yeah. So I'm reading Hick. I'm also reading I'm finally sitting down to read The Unchangeable Spots of Leopards by Christopher Jansma.
Okay.
Rebecca tried to get me to read that for a year, and I kept putting it off and putting it off, and it's like, I don't know. I think mostly it was because, when you look at his bio, he's like one of those people that had all of the right doors open, all the right opportunities. It's just like didn't have to. It was just, kind of, wrote the manuscript while he was in grad school, and it got picked up by an agent, who knew somebody. I don't remember his exact story. I actually met him, and then we talked a little bit about it. But it was. Now, I kind of resisted it because it was like, oh, you weren't even into your 30s yet, and you got your first book published. And I was nearly 40. So kind of that resentment was hovering over that. And I was like, and I met him and I talked to him, and by the time I met him and talked to him, I'd been listening to Marc Maron's podcast, WTF.
Okay.
And he's a comedian. I think you would like him if you. Do you have a Netflix account?
Yeah.
Look for Thinky Pain by Marc
What's it
Maron.
called?
Thinky Pain?
Thinky
Think
pain?
with
Okay.
Thinky Pain. Think Y Pain.
Huh.
Thinky
Okay.
Pain. And if you listen to podcasts at any time, you'll have a chance to do that. Check out WTF. He talks to other comedians and musicians and actors and whatever, and it's brilliant. But I think listening to him, I kind of, resonated. I feel like he's a kindred spirit. He's like that slightly older brother who, if I listen to him, I might actually get my life figured out before I die. Not that he has his life figured out, but he's 10 years older than I am and is dealing with the same issues. So if I just, watch. But anyway, he made this point of talking about how, you if and I've learned and I've heard other people talk about it as well, and it finally clicked in for some reason with him, is that yes, there are some people that can have a lot of great opportunities early on, and it seems like they just get to walk into doing this thing that you and I have tried so hard to do and at times failed at miserably and struggled and whatever. The point is, after they walk through that door, after somebody opens up that opportunity for them, they still have to do the work. And they might get one shot. And if they don't do the work, if they don't actually have the talent and the discipline and the determination, they're not going to get the second one out. All this stuff that we think, we're sitting here going, I have talent and drive and determination. Where's my opportunity? right? We sit there and think that these people, they got the opportunity, but they can't keep it unless they have the same talent, drive, and determination.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
So I've kind of stepped back from that level, that level of anger and resentment that I used to have. You know, oh, that person, right?
Yep.
You know, because I realized that, yeah, you know, they still have to do the work for the second book. Yep. They still have to to live up to it. They can't skate by. No one's going to, if they fuck it off and half-ass it and don't do the work, no one's going to publish it just because they did the first time. You know, so it's a bit of a comfort, you know.
Yeah.
And it's good. The Unchangeable Spots of Leopard, pretty good. I'm not far enough in it to say that what Rebecca saw in it is what I'm going to see in it, but we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
But she raved about it. She loves it. Mm-hmm. She really, really wanted me to read it. I don't know. Maybe because I resisted reading it is why she broke up with me. I don't know. But then I have a whole stack of stuff that I've got lined up. Well, shit, most of my, after packing and moving and everything, most of my books on the shelves over here are stuff I haven't read. All my stuff that I read is in boxes still.
Oh. Yeah. That's a good way to separate them.
See, I picked up Malloy by Samuel Beckett and Wittgenstein's Mistress, which were recommendations from, Wittgenstein's Mistress was a recommendation from Laird, and Malloy was one from, Brian Evanson.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, those are the ones I'm trying to read that are related. And they're also related to some of the projects that I'm trying to work on.
Oh, very good. So it's good to connect what you're working on with what you're reading.
Because I don't know, maybe I'm overthinking a lot of the projects that I'm trying to work on right now, but I don't know.
What are you working on?
Well, that's why I wanted to talk to you. Because I'm stuck, I'm spinning my wheels, and I think you're the best person to help me out here. Because okay, the project that I'm stuck on, one project at the end, and then I've got two projects that I'm oscillating between.
Okay.
And so you've got, the one I'm stuck on is, I'm calling it right now, FAR 19. It's also called my Tulsa project. Although it's not actually set in Tulsa. I had to create a fictional city because I wanted to screw with the timeline.
Mm-hmm.
And then put a dead body in the time capsule. Right?
Uh-huh.
So I couldn't actually base it in, you know, in Tulsa and what really happened in Tulsa, but they mirror each other. So, you know, in the 20s, Tulsa had a 3-day race riot that completely obliterated the African-American community there. And then in the late 50s, the Tulsa City Council put together a time capsule and put it inside a gold Plymouth Belvedere, and then buried the car, you know, in a crypt.
Uh-huh.
And there had been a contest, guess the population of Tulsa in 2008, and, you know, you'll win the car. So when it came time to open up that time capsule, everybody's kind of looking forward to see if the car survived and who would win this gold car, right? Well, apparently something had gone wrong with the crypt, and it leaked, and it filled up with water, and the car was just rusted through. Just an absolute wreck. Now, of course, everything that had been sealed up in the time capsule that was put in the trunk survived, you know, intact, the time capsule. itself survived, but everything else was a wreck. I thought it was really just kind of fascinating. You had this, you know, buried car time capsule that was done in the 50s, and there was actually some stuff that was put in the car that was, they'd specifically reached out to African-American citizens to put it in there. And there was some, you know, there's, and then there, and for me reading about this, there was the overtones of this riot. I thought this would be a good place to put a story.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course the dead body pops up. So I have this story where people are coming back to the town. I call it Kedowa. Which, if I remember my research right, I took that name. It's an Indian place name that actually means something like cemetery or graveyard.
Ooh, that's kind of cool.
You know, so this guy comes back to the town to unearth the time capsule, and he's the son of the city planner who put the time capsule in the ground. And, you know, this city planner, I imagined, is this kind of Branch Rickey type of character. He was going to integrate his department, and his right-hand man was an African-American war veteran who had twin sons, Emmett and Walter. And Emmett and Walter were the same age as John, the son of the city planner. So they grew up together, went to high school together. After the Brown v. Board of Education, they played on the same football team at the same high school together, which is kind of where the title comes from. It's supposed to be the audible that John, the quarterback, would call, and his friend Walter would run a post route, and, you know, it was their secret weapon because he was fast. Okay. Right. and his jersey number was 19, so, you know, that type of whole thing, whatever. But Walter disappeared the night of that the time capsule was supposed to go in, and everybody thought he had hopped a bus and gone to Mexico. That's what he said he was going to do, and that's where John and this woman, Ella, left him at the bus station, getting on the bus to go to Mexico. Hannibal, the father of the two twin sons, he had been in Kedowa during the riot and had seen his father get killed during the riot. So there's this whole family connection to everything that's going on there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically the setting. You come back in, there's the missing brother. The living brother has gotten it into his head over the last 50 years that their friend John had killed Walter and put him in the time capsule. Everybody calls Emmett crazy because nobody believes this story, and he's been telling it for years.
Yeah.
And of course what happens is they pull out the car, they open up the car, and there's Walter's corpse. Right? So that sets off the whole thing with the story. And so there's these dual threads. There's the confrontation between Emmett and John over, you know, whether or not John actually killed Walter. There's kind of a lopsided love quadrangle, because John was and this woman Ella were dating, and it was, and, you know, of course in the 50s, you know, before really the end of segregation, so, you know, the complete end of segregation, but certainly not the end of racism.
No.
And so they'd been dating secretly, even though Emmett was in love with Ella, and Walter was gay and in love with John. So
oh God.
It's another one of those, you know, it's like where I just started writing and all these, I just started, it was like, I stopped at one point and go, you have to stay away from the kitchen sink. You know?
Yeah.
Keep it under control, man. Come on. So I've got that thread. That's all that, the whole kids thread. And then I've got the parents thread. Hannibal and Connor, who is John's father. These were the city planner and his assistant. And a rift between them that had to do with the time capsule and its relation to the riot and to the obliterated African-American part of the city that had been turned into a giant park, which people said was actually a mass grave.
Ooh.
So Hannibal is still alive. He's in his late 80s, early 90s. And when they unearth the body, he kind of snaps and wanders around the town for a night and ends up in the park where the old African-American neighborhood used to be, and with a trenching tool starts to dig up the foundation to his parents' house. You know, and he's being helped by spirits. So I'm trying to throw in some magical realism. There's ghosts and all this other stuff like that. And I've gotten sort of to the end of the story. And it's kind of like I've bogged down and hit mud.
Yeah.
Because, you know, John didn't kill his best friend, even though his best friend was gay. And even though his other best friend, the twin brother, thinks he did it, that didn't happen.
Yeah.
He's just got to prove it. And then, of course, there's the jealousy because Ella was in love with John, but then John never came back to town, so Ella married Emmett after he came back from Vietnam, and they had a daughter. And now the daughter and John's son are kind of, you know, having a moment. And I'm trying to tie up all these threads, and it's like, fuck, I have to, and I don't know if what I have to do is shed a character and pull back on the focalization. Because I've got it spread out again, like I did in Shadows, like all these people. And I... So...
Because it seems like you're telling the story almost of a town. Through the people.
Right.
So, yeah, so how do you bring it back to where it's about the town? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'm articulating this right, but I can kind of see it in my head. Because you're telling the story through the characters telling the story of the town. It feels to me like at the end we want to know what happens to all those people, of course.
Right.
But you can almost. But is there a way you could do it by having something happen in the town that kind of ties off all the ends?
Yeah, I've.
I don't know.
One of the little subplots to the to Hannibal's story. He's the 90-year-old ex assistant of the city planner, who's digging up his parents' house in the park. Mm-hmm. One of the ways that he's been hiding from the police, who are looking for him because he's gone missing from his nursing home, is that he's been sleeping during the day in abandoned bomb shelters, because one of the little sub stories of the city is that during the Korean War and just after, we with all the big nuclear scares that were going on in the 50s, there was a surge of building bomb shelters, you know, illegally even, throughout the city. So the city is riddled with abandoned, forgotten bomb shelters. And it's in those bomb shelters in the 50s where Kedua's gay community would meet, you know, to hide and keep themselves secret. And that's where Walter met his end. That's where he ended up getting killed. And then dumped in the car.
Okay.
So, and that's kind of the key to resolving, at least that's what I think now. I don't know. I mean, I feel like I've kind of, I don't feel like I've set it up right in the story.
Okay.
What I've written. So I don't know.
That seems, as you were telling me what's going on, that's the part that draws me in the most is, who killed this guy, you know? I mean, he's
right.
Who did it? I want to find out. I want that resolved.
Yeah. And I've maybe my problem is I went on this tangent where the two children, even though the son and the daughter are in their 30s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then Emmett and John, who went to high school and graduated in 60 when the time capsule will put in, they're both in their 70s or close to it.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Hannibal's in his 90s. And so I've got this multi-generational thing.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like I'm trying to do too much. So I don't know what I need to pull back, or if I went too far down this route where the kids seem to be, you know, Scooby doing the damn thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, if you imagine the story is a big photograph.
Right.
And you wanted somebody to look at the picture and know exactly, kind of just get a gist of what was going on. Doesn't have to know everything, but get a pretty good feeling of what was happening in the picture.
Mm-hmm.
What could you take out of that picture and it wouldn't affect anything? Is there anything?
Yeah. I'd have to take out the kids doing all the library research and sleuthing.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'd have to take that out. I think if I'm going to pursue their relationship, it's got to be based on something else other than what I've had them doing. That makes sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you're right. Yeah. No, that's a good one. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, I think that's one way to look at it, is visually.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, one thing I always wanted to do, I never worked with that book I tried writing, was mapping it out, like literally putting it up on a wall.
Oh, right, right.
How it all linked together, where it fell apart, where, you know, because it was such a weird storyline. I wanted it to work.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, just to visually see it. And that's, you know, and like I would tell people when I tutor or teach writing, you know, do a reverse outline or something like that, or map out your paper or your story or whatever you're doing, and to see where things are linking. So I'm thinking, right, for you in that scenario, I just see a picture of like the 30s in Oklahoma.
Right.
I this kind of that old yellowish kind of picture in my head is with all these people in it. And I'm just like, what can I live without? You know?
Right.
So.
Okay. Yeah.
And it reminds me of something that, I don't know who said it. Someone we knew said, you know, if you get stuck with a character or you get stuck with an idea, break their leg.
That sounds like it would be Chris Bear.
That probably was Chris Bear. But yeah, it's like, what do you do when this character gets boring? Break his leg. You know, you know, so if you feel like you're getting stuck in mud, whose leg can you break?
Okay.
That sounds really interesting, though. I can see that coming to life. I really can.
Yeah. Well, I've gotten so far along on it, I don't mind talking about the story, because it's a matter of finishing it now. I've told most of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of
just how it all wrap up.
I have to tie up something.
Yeah.
In some way. Okay. Yeah, that's a good one. I need to do that. I need to get some. I'll get another one. I got. Out in the living room, I've got one of those giant post-it note presenter things that, you know, that's like you tack on the wall and you can take off these big, like 3x3 pages of.
I'll
break that out and use that
would
that
be
here.
Very cool. It might not be useful, but I mean, it's worth a shot.
Well, to get the brain going, which is kind of what mm-hmm. I've been struggling to do. I mean, okay. Yeah,
so seeing it from a different perspective can re-energize it a little bit, or, you know.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah, because I'm at this point now where it's I'm so frustrated with that one that I just want to abandon it and go
Oh,
start
don't do that.
one of these other two projects. You
Yeah.
know?
No, that sounds good. I wouldn't abandon it. There's a lot
Hoping that,
there.
yeah, hoping that, you know, if I let it sit, then I could. But sometimes
Another
letting it
thing
sit
too is,
means you never go back to it.
yeah, exactly. And also think
'Cause
about what doesn't need to be said, or to what part of the
it's
story doesn't need to be told, what could just be implied or almost just given.
right.
Just like to let the reader take away what they will from whatever part of the story you need to let them take away from.
Right. Okay. Yeah. No, because I, do you remember when I was talking about, this would have been back when we were still in Boulder together, my actual kitchen sink story
Oh, God.
that had, you know, like the whole world consp it was how it was the story about how conspiracy theories actually exist, but the conspiracy theory is actually that there are conspiracy theories.
I
Right?
know.
You know, because I have, at one point I remember I must have had like I think I still have. Well, I still have it. It's still here on my desktop. Where is it? There it is. The God Tamers. It's something like 400 pages. It's almost 4 megabytes worth of novel.
Oh, wow.
Let's see. There, statistics. Yeah, this was I'd reached a point where I felt like I'd put so much in it that had to be mapped out, and I ended up abandoning it to go and pursue something else. And have never gone back to it. In fact, I've written, let's see, I'm trying to remember if I had the Korea novel finished before I started this one. I think I did. Yeah, so I've written an entire novel since I abandoned this one.
Wow.
Yeah, 70,000 words, and I just walked away from it
Jeez.
because it got hard.
Well,
Maybe I'll go
sometimes,
back.
sometimes it's you abandon stuff, not you necessarily, but people will abandon stuff because they need to, because it just needs to be
Yeah.
abandoned. It may feel like it may not feel it was a lot of work. It's a lot of effort, it's a lot of pages, it's a lot of words, but
Yeah.
sometimes.
Okay. I think I got something I can work with. Thank you.
Oh, good. You're welcome.
Yeah. But no, the Beckett and the Wittgenstein's Mistress, those are for a couple of different projects. Well, those are actually for an idea that I'm committed to writing because I imagined it as being the second book of a trilogy. So I'm out trying to sell the first book right now. So I have to write the second one. I'm obligated to do it. I've got a three book project right now that I'm in the very middle of, so I have to do it. And I want to do it badly. Because you know the Palace of Winds is supposed to be this retelling of Jason the Argonauts and this fictionalized biography of my grandfather. And the second one I want to work on is supposed to be about my dad.
Are we talking about that one?
Yeah. And that's the one that's got to be structured like the maze, the labyrinth from the Minotaur myth.
Ah.
How the fuck do I do that? Right? Because you remember in grad school when we had that fiction panel our second summer?
I think so.
About what is story?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we were talking about, you know, but somebody brought up Freytag's triangle, and someone had brought up Chris Bear's analogy that, you know, you chase the protagonist up a tree and see how he gets down.
Yep.
And we had talked about this idea of a story being a spiral. You know, that it wasn't a straight line, that it wasn't linear, but it would spiral.
Mm-hmm.
And I've kind of been obsessed with that because that's, in a way, that's kind of how a maze gets started. You got...
What is that? Oh, crap. What is that name? It's basically, it's like the spiral being the shape that recurs throughout nature, throughout everything. It's some Italian guy. And he oh my God, it's going to drive me crazy. There's a Tool song. I can't remember the name of the Tool song either. Shane will know. I'll have to ask him. But basically, right. it's like there's a series of numbers that all add up to certain other numbers, and it's like the spiral is like the center
Fibonacci?
Of everything. Yes.
Really? Yes. That was a wild guess. I pulled right out of my ass.
That was really a good guess. That was it. Yeah. Fibonacci, or what it said, sequence, I think is what it was called.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a Tool song. Lateralis, I think, or is it not an album? I don't remember, but. Where if like somebody had broken it down by that sequence, broken the song down, and it was really kind of cool. But the idea of the spiral, you know, just that kind of reminded me of that. You know, when I look into that, it's kind of cool.
Right.
But anyway, I'm sorry to off track you there, but
no, that's you throw the stuff out there. That's kind of I think why we were why we developed the way we did is because we talked to each other that way. It's just let it go, man.
Yep.
it's been a long time since we've actually done this on purpose.
That's true.
You know, because that was the thing that's bothered me. Yeah, you can imagine a story as a spiral, but the problem is that physically the natural world, even if you put it on film, like Memento. Even mm-hmm. if you take something that's supposed to be a disjointed, non-linear narrative, we still physically, as human beings, experience it in a linear fashion.
Yep.
Right?
That's true.
You know, so... Because
it's like, how do you achieve narrative depth?
Right. You still have to open that book and go read from left to right.
Yep.
No matter what, no matter how I do it, you still have to read left to right, and you still turn that page in that fashion. Mm-hmm. You know, you can get cute like manga comics and reverse
or,
it.
Yeah, or read Hebrew.
Right.
But, you know, but yeah, it's linear.
So. So, you know, at one point, trying to dig my way into this story and what I wanted it to be, I was thinking about kind of pulling a page from Mondace's Coming Through Slaughter
mm-hmm.
and the collected works of Billy the Kid. And... creating narrative sections that would, you know, work like vignettes and fit on 1 to 2 pages.
Uh-huh.
So that, you know, the you wouldn't have to turn the page at any time to get a full piece. So if you had a two-page vignette, it would be on a left page and a right page.
Oh, that's kind of a cool idea.
And it would not, so that, you know, you lay the book open flat. You wouldn't have to start reading at the top of the, you'd always start reading at the top of the left page. And at the bottom of the right page, that would be the end of that vignette. You turn the page and it would be something different. So that would have to be the way it's set up. Everything confined to one or two pages like that. And then what I wanted to do was have each section numbered, but not actually have page numbers.
Okay. That's right? Cool. Yeah.
And then what I would do is I would then randomize the numbered sections, except that section number one would be a two-page split, so you'd open the book to the very middle, and that would be number one. That would be the opening scene. And then kind of like a choose-your-own-adventure book, you could hunt around for section two and read the story that way, so you did one and then flip a bunch of pages to number two, flip a bunch of pages back, you know, to number three. You know, or you would start there in the middle with one, and then you could either read towards the front of the book, like a manga comic, or you could read towards the back of the book, or, you know, do whatever. I thought that would fucking drive printers insane. And plus, I don't know that I would, I don't know how to figure that out. I mean, logistically, as how to control the creation of it.
I mean, because in order to, like, an online creation.
Right.
Yeah. That take away from the whole experience, I think.
Because I think what I'd have to do is I'd have to either, it would take me years and years to write, just writing, you know, basically it would be impressions, bits of poetry, mm-hmm. bits of prose, whatever, all tied around, you know, I'd almost have to make an outline of what I wanted to cover and then just mm-hmm. kind of free write based on what came to me on any given day. And then I'd have to spend years, you know, okay, do I want this to be scene number one? And, you know, how do I want the story to go if they read towards the front of the book first and then go back and pick up the back half of the book? You know.
Yeah.
Oh, I was making this way, way too hard for myself. Do you remember how in grad school we used to talk about people, writers like James Joyce or whatever, eventually eating their own brain, just becoming so self-obsessed that they're mm-hmm. that they're writing, you know, kind of lost touch with the outside world.
Yeah,
I felt like that's what I was doing. Following that, as I was just chewing up my own noggin.
Yeah, that's an intense idea.
Yeah, and then on the other hand, I'm sitting there thinking, well, you know, I mean, I never imagined this trilogy as something that would come out in real rapid succession. You know, because they're kind of difficult topics and difficult ideas, and you kind of have to grow into them. So it's not going to be a big deal if I don't get to it right away.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got other things I want to work on. Yeah, I was making myself into this, you know, you can never die immortal life plan. You know, I'd have to download myself into a computer probably to finish it if I were going to do the whole read it, you know, choose your own adult adventure type of thing.
Yeah. How funny. Those are fun books, though. I used to love those as a kid.
Yeah. I kind of got frustrated with him because I always wanted to know all the possibilities. I was never happy. You know, having to flip pages a lot was the most frustrating thing in the world to me. So, yeah. And I once had, okay, the other project that I've been struggling to get into,
mm-hmm.
which is the only reason I'm struggling to get into it is because I was stuck with the first one. Did I ever talk to you about, I'm sure I did, I had to have talked to you about my desire to write the most beautiful, heartbreaking story ever.
Yeah.
You know, most people want to write the great American novel. What I want to write is the story that makes everyone weep. You know, uncontrollably. Uh-huh. I want grown, thick-necked football players to read this story and, you know.
Yeah.
Dry their eyes on their jock straps. You know, I mean.
That would be tough.
Yeah. Oh, I think I have the story.
Oh.
So, the only problem is, I can't get into it. And probably the reason I wasn't getting any traction is because my brain's still trying to kick over the whole FAR 19 problem.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Yeah.
Sometimes it's good to just work on one thing at a time if you can. or not worry too much about something you can't get, you know, into too well.
Right, right.
If you're still wrapped up in something else.
So, what were the two words you wrote down and crossed out?
Oh, I don't remember. Let me see. Hold on a second. Let me see if I can find them. This is my notebook. What were those two words? So, I've.
Right, right.
That's it. I crossed them out. So, I've. Yeah.
Survived cancer.
That might have been where I was going with it. I don't know.
Yeah, who knows?
I was like, I was sitting there, I wrote it, and I'm like, fuck it. It's crossed it out. Like, the fuck would work.
So what was in your head when you got done with that first Sedaris book and almost started writing? What was the driver? What was the thing?
The humor. I think, mm-hmm. was what did it. I just, that was driving me, was how humorous he was without being overly funny. You know,
right.
I'm like, I could do that. I'm like, I could be funny in that way in my writing. If I really wanted to, I probably could pull it off a little bit, not as well as he does, but, you know, I could probably pull off a little humor. And I was like, why not? You know?
Yeah.
Joke around about some stuff that's been happening and the comedy that is my career path, you know, just stuff like that. You know, that's what really was the driver.
So were you wanting to do personal essays then or something like that?
Yeah,
or?
I think I was.
Okay.
I think that's where I was headed with it, was just kind of, you know, maybe not making them more interesting than they really were in life. Because
mm-hmm.
he made, you know, losing his passport the absolutely most entertaining story ever. You know, and it's like, who gives a shit? You lost your passport. But it was hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
And it was well written, and it just was, you know, it was good.
Cool. Now, you said recently that you and your dad finally found all of your old files.
Uh-huh.
It was everything, all the stories from grad school and before, right?
Yep, everything. Most of it was grad school, but.
And did it all make you cringe, or?
The stuff
it was
I looked
one
at
those...
didn't make you cringe too bad.
Right, right. Have you thought about maybe trying to revise them as a way to kind of get your gears starting again?
I have thought about that. And I don't know. something wants me to just leave them be too.
Right.
It was written at a certain time. That's the way it was written. It was going to stay that way. It's dead. You know.
Right.
Some of it, I don't know.
Well, what about White Dwarves?
Oh God.
Is that?
I don't know what to do with that. Yeah, that's my monster. I don't know what to do with it. I always come up with something new to do with it, and I change my mind. I'm like, no, I'll do that.
Now, do I have, at one point, you thought you had lost it, so I'd sent you the version that I had?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is that the complete version, or do you have more?
It's just two parts. It didn't add up to very much. I forget how many pages it ended up being. I think I have it all that I actually written. I never knew how to end it, so kind of gave up on it.
Yeah. Interesting. If you get a chance, you should check out Point of Direction by Rachel Weaver.
Okay.
I interviewed her for the podcast a little while ago. Uh-huh. She's a Naropa grad.
Oh, cool.
I think she finished her MFA there. No, she got there a couple of years after we did. And she was actually, at least for a year maybe or two, because she, I think, just turned 40. Maybe she doesn't want me to say that. I don't know, whatever. I think we talked about it at some point. Anyway, so she's in between you and me. And I think for a while she was actually, I'd have to go back and listen to the timeline again, but I think she was in Boulder in between finishing her undergrad a couple of years, like in 96 or 98 or something. Somewhere around in there.
Okay.
And then before she went to Alaska, she was floating around in Boulder still while we were there.
Oh.
Starting graduate school. Since you did your undergrad at CU, you and her would have had more overlap in Boulder. So you were both in Boulder at the same time for a while. She then went off and tracked bears in Alaska for a number of years.
Oh my gosh.
Right. But she had taken, workshops at like the free university there in Boulder with Max Reagan.
Oh.
So she's known Max, probably longer than we have.
And it was because of
Max that Rachel ended up doing the MFA at Naropa. And her first book was just published early this year, Point of Direction.
Cool.
And it's really good.
Is it?
I think you would like it. Yes. You would like it very, very much. So, yeah, check that one out. They're actually, a couple of Naropa grads that are starting to get some, real good press. Laird and Rachel.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I guess Chris got some good press, and then whatever happened to Godspeed, I don't know.
Yeah, he just kind of disappeared, didn't he?
I've hesitated. I don't know if I want to reach out to him and talk to him for the podcast. I don't know if
that
he'd be willing to.
Yeah. But,
so do you have on your list ready for September, Never Home, Laird Hunt's new novel? It'll be out in September.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Okay.
I'll definitely be getting that.
I have some other books that are there are some other books that are coming out in September that I'm going to recommend to you, but I think I'll save those for later, or maybe just get you a copy and send them to you.
Email me a list.
Cool. So what are you do you have anything percolating in the background that you're thinking about writing?
I had this weird inspiration last night, actually. We were watching something on YouTube about sacred geometry. And there's a Japanese guy named Masaru Emoto who wrote like a dozen books about water, just water crystals, and how, or water droplets, should I say, and how they change. Like you take a picture of it, they look a certain way. They look almost like a snowflake, or they look, whatever. But they completely change based on music being played near the water, or words being said to the water. And just for some reason, I find it absolutely fascinating. And so I'm like, that'd be really cool just to have a series of stories that all start off with a picture of this water droplet, of different water droplets, and the different things that have been said to the water, and then have that be the theme of the story.
Yeah,
So it's just kind of this random thing that popped in my head.
I think that guy's work also made an appearance in a sort of movie-ish, narrative movie documentary-ish type of thing called What the Bleep Do We Know?
Oh, did he?
And it's a very interesting, very fascinating movie. I have a copy of it on DVD, but some of the assertions that were made in that movie were debunked. And some of the scientists that they had talked to after they saw the movie were like, it's kind of taken out of context. But no, I'm not trying to discourage you, but I'm saying look into it. You might find something not quite what you're looking for, but something deeper.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
You might find the story. Which might broaden what you the nugget of the idea.
Yeah, this is just kind of a flight of ideas. Just kind of like, oh, that'd be interesting.
Yeah, your brain still works. You're just out of practice.
Oh, so hard practice.
Yeah, I need to get you writing again. You need to get
Yeah,
writing again.
I know.
Entirely selfish on my part, just entirely selfish. I'm never gonna deny that. Because I was Your stories were always incredibly impressive to me. Incredibly. The Good Life just floored me. I don't know if I've ever really expressed how wonderful I think that story is. And I know I'm right about that one because so is Joyce Carol Oates. Right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think the world is a poorer place when you're not writing. That's my thought. Just to screw in the guilt just a little bit more. Yeah. I mean, you and Gavin were two of the people that I wrote against the most. I had to do something that would be as good as what I thought you guys were writing and that would keep you guys impressed.
And you did.
Well, Okay. Maybe what we ought to do, because you know, if you wanted to get hooked up with Skype, we could get you and me and Gavin on a Skype call and do this.
That'd be fun.
Because I don't think the three of us have had a conversation since his wedding.
No, probably not.
Let's get that set up. That'll want to try that next month?
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Okay. Don't go anywhere. I think we've got everything we need. We've already been on here for an hour and 15 minutes.
Okay.
if anybody's still listening, thank you, everybody. This is how at least these two writers work. This was how we worked in graduate school. And I kind of needed that. Thank you. So, don't go anywhere.
Okay.
All right, there you have it. Thanks for listening. I hope you got something out of that. Be back in 2 weeks. Should have a brand new regular episode of the Outrider Podcast. I'm not sure who I'm going to talk to yet, but we'll find out. And then in a month from now, in 4 weeks, we'll have another shop talk with Laura and find out how the projects we were wrestling with are working on and whether or not she's written something. Ta-da! Thanks for listening.